That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
Doing pretty well. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing all right. I am grateful to have my family close. This is part two of our interview with John Palmer, who lost his wife, Katie Palmer, back in April of 2020 in a very tragic automobile incident.
And I just want to, like I said, in the first part of this interview, in the first episode, it's not a disclaimer for anything particularly graphic in regards to the accident, but it's a disclaimer to prepare yourself for the emotion that's coming with this, especially, like you said, Tim, you're grateful to have your family close to you. This is someone who had his family completely ripped apart out of the blue for no better reason than they were walking one morning, and it makes no sense. So yes, that's my disclaimer. Just brace yourself, but you have to hear it. Like, you have to hear his words, you have to hear his voice, his emotion, and how he wraps the whole thing up.
Okay, and go to justiceforkatiepalmer.com, and there's links to their social pages as well. Make sure to follow it, and please share. This is something that the Palmers want. They want accountability and justice for Katie Palmer.
And when you're on that website, go to the Get Involved tab, and it says how you can help. You can share Katie's story, like you said. You can voice your opinion to Texas state officials. You can sign the petition, and you can ask your favorite content creator to cover Katie's story. We said it before, and we'll say it again. Our peers in this podcasting industry, if you haven't covered her story, get in touch with John through that website, or you can contact us, and we'll make the connection for you. It's important to tell her story because they simply want justice. There's also a link there to file a complaint against a state trooper to the Texas Department of Safety Inspector General. So you can follow that link to voice your opinion like they encourage you to do.
All right. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. We really appreciate it. Follow us at crawlspace-media.com.
And one more quick bit of news before we get to the interview. If anybody is in town, in Worcester, in Wormtown, on Saturday, November 13th, the show Death by Incarceration, hosted by Suave Gonzalez and Kevin McCracken, that's a show that's on our Crawlspace Media Network. They will be performing live at the Brick Box Theater in Worcester. Tickets are available via the link in the show notes. You can also check them out on their social media. They'll be posting about that with the link to the ticket sales. Their Twitter is DB Incarceration, so they will have that link in their Twitter and on their Instagram. Again, that's Saturday, November 13th, with special guest Nikki Bell from the Lyft organization right there in the heart of Worcester, Massachusetts. Thank you.
There was a grand jury that was convened, right?
There was a grand jury on August 19th. And a grand jury in Texas consists of 12. That day, one juror called in sick. So that dropped us down to 11. And then another juror recused himself because he either knew Corey or he knew me. They did not replace those jurors with alternates. So we went in there with 10. And in Texas, you have to get 9 grand jurors to vote for an indictment. And so we had to get 9 out of 10.
So it would have been 9 out of 12. Sorry to interrupt. It would have been 9 out of 12 if there were 12 people there.
Correct. So if you have one person, if you had two people that just didn't like the color of my shirt that day for one reason or another, it could have been a myriad of reasons why. I asked the prosecutor, Kerry Ashmore, that day, why weren't the other two, juror seats filled? And his response was, I don't know. Didn't get a reason why we didn't get a full grand jury. I know now, as of 2021, there has been legislation that has been passed and enacted to where you have to have 12. So, yeah, I mean, and there are some cases where only 9 grand jurors were present and you had to get all 9 to, vote. They didn't have all the evidence that day. They did not have the phone records. They also did not have that third party report. So they had, DPS did not recreate the scene, okay? Which is from other law enforcement officers and other troopers, I've heard that's crazy. I mean, this is what DPS does. When it comes to traffic accidents, state troopers, that's one of their sole responsibilities is to investigate these accidents, or in my case, incidents, because I don't think this was an accident, and supposed to gather as much information as possible. Obviously, from what I've said, Sharif Al-Khatib did not do his job that day at all. He didn't collect the evidence that was in Corey Foster's body, nor did he mark the scene. DPS as a whole failed because they did not recreate the accident. Grayson County hired a third-party firm to come out and recreate that wreck. They did that. The gentleman that reconstructed that testified in front of the grand jury. Now, what the grand jury didn't have was his final report. The grand jury was on August 19th. The date of the final report was August 25th. Six days, which there's no reason for that at all. That report was very damning towards Corey Foster. Very damning. Put all the liability, obviously, on Corey Foster. Listed everything that he did wrong. Did mention that alcohol could have been a contributing factor. Did mention that it didn't matter if the fog or the sun obstructed his vision as a driver and an operator of a motor vehicle. Those are conditions that other drivers have to deal with as well. If you cannot drive and you can't, pardon me, if you cannot see, then you should not drive. And you sure should not drive for 38 seconds or 3/10 of a mile. He made that decision to continue to operate his motor vehicle in a reckless manner. That was not given to the grand jury at all.
Yeah, I mean, you took the words out of my mouth. I'm sitting here listening to this and thinking, it doesn't matter. Like, we've all driven in a car that has a foggy window or a windshield, and we've all driven into the sun, and we slow down, and we put the visor down, and we're like, I don't know about you guys, but I'm like hyper aware when I'm in that situation because I don't want something like that happening. That's, I mean, at the very, very, very least, it's just reckless driving. Not just, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just reckless.
If that's not what reckless driving is, then I would like for somebody to tell me what it is.
Well, maybe he had to have been on the phone at the time. Oh, he was.
He absolutely was. So we have somebody who was visually distracted, couldn't see out of his windshield, whether he wants to blame it on the fog, whether he wants to blame it on the sun. I've never heard the weatherman tell me it's going to be a really foggy, sunny day. Which if you look at the DPS report, they interchange. I think they only mentioned condensation once, which that's what it was. It was condensation on his windshield that allowed him not to see. But the report says fog all over the place. So he says that he was distracted by the fog and the sun, which you can't have both. I mean, I don't think I've never been out on a foggy day and been, man, this sun is horrible. Never. So it was the condensation on his windshield that he could not clear, obviously for 0.3 mile. And it was the also added excuse of, I guess, the sun hitting the condensation that further visually distracted him. It was also the manual distraction that he had in his hand by dialing the number. And let's also throw in the fact that his cognitive functions were impaired, slowed, or dulled by the fact that he had a strong presence of alcohol coming from his body. And we don't know what else was in his body. And the reason why I say that is because if you look at the body camera footage from that day, very emotionally flat. I believe that he was on some other sort of substance, whether it was, I don't want to make any speculations, but there was, in my opinion, something else that day that impaired him cognitively. So there are three major issues there that led to him speeding, crossing over the roadway, hitting two people, not knowing what he hit, sending one to the ICU, and killing another. And instead of being taken to the hospital for a blood test, Tarif Al-Khatib loaded him up in his cruiser, drove him home.
He went home after?
Yeah, he went home. The trooper allowed him to get his two Glocks out of his truck. That...
What?
Yeah, oh man. Yeah, so when they were doing the inventory of his truck, they asked if he had any weapons. And he said, yes, I have two Glocks. The trooper then asked him, are they loaded? He said, yes. The trooper goes, okay, why don't you get them out and hand them to me?
What?
It's all going to be listed down in inventory.
Okay.
Texoma Auto Care is two pistols. Gonna have get it. Let's get those pistols out. Okay. Yeah, let's get those out.
You want to do it?
No, you can get them.
Are they loaded?
Yeah. You didn't do any good without
it. Yeah. Two Glocks, huh?
Yeah. And I'm not even a Glock fan.
Let me ask you guys a question. If you ever got pulled over by a police officer and the police officer asked you if you had loaded weapons in your vehicle and you said yes, what are the chances that that officer is going to go, okay, why don't you go ahead and hand them to me? 0.0. And I'll tell you why Tarif Al-Khatib let Corey Foster do that is because Tarif Al-Khatib knew Corey. Tarif Al-Khatib had a pre-existing relationship with Corey Foster. Again, on social media, because that's our only platform other than these great podcasts that we've done. I've got pictures of them at a Halloween party together the year before, which is less than 4 or 5 months. And then the wives at a Christmas party arm in arm. They were friendly. They knew each other. And the wives used to work together. They both were hairdressers. Grayson County is a small county, but it's not a tiny county. You know, there's probably 100,000 that are in Grayson County. So, I mean, it's not like a small county out in West Texas that, you know, encompasses hundreds of thousands of square miles and has, you know, 30,000 people. He knew Corey. Again, just to go back to that one statement that I made where he was talking to the other troopers, stating that as soon as I walked up and saw it was him, I was like, he's probably drunk. So why a trooper would make that statement, I don't know, but I do not believe that he thought that the body camera of Trooper David Taylor was on. Well, it was on and it recorded everything he said. And we've already released that out. We've given that to the DA as well. And the way that they handled themselves that day on scene was anything but professional. Going back, and I'm sorry, I hope I'm not jumping all over the place here. Tarif had two conversations with a supervisor. And I was also told by law enforcement officers and other state troopers that with something like this, a supervisor should have come out on scene. For some reason, they didn't. But they talked to him twice on the phone. And when Tarif relayed what happened to Katie, to his supervisor on the phone, his words were, "She just whacked her head real good." Those were his exact words. Okay. Fast forward to when it's just the troopers on scene and all the ambulance have gone, the wrecker has left with the truck. I'm going to use some explicit language here. I'm sorry. Tarif's words to the other troopers were, he knocked the shit out of her, dude. Those were his words to the troopers when he thought the other body camera was off. So what he tells his supervisor and what he thinks are two different things. Now, something else, going back to when he gave Corey Foster a ride home, it's DPS policy that if you have anybody in your vehicle that you leave your body camera on or you leave the in-unit camera on. When Tarif went to go take Corey Foster home, he had the camera off the entire time. So that whole conversation going back to his house, and his house is only 3/10 of a mile away, going back to his house, there is no recording at all. And there's no recording of a man who you let back into your vehicle with two loaded weapons. That's a gross deviation from DPS policy.
How is this person still in a position of authority?
He's been promoted twice since.
Oh my God.
What I've been told by other troopers is that sometimes promotions take place to get guys like Tarif off the street, which is completely backwards. But he's been in for 13 years and he gets promoted once and then he gets promoted again because of time and service. And now he's only on the road 2 times a month. So he won't have the opportunity to make mistakes.
And throughout this incident, did Foster ever say where he was going?
His words were that he was headed to go pick up some guys to go do some work. Those were his exact words. He was headed to go pick up some guys to go do some work. That's all.
Did anyone ever confirm that that story with the so-called guys?
That would mean that an investigation would have had to have taken place, right? And we know that that didn't happen.
Do you know who he called?
I have an idea, but I don't know. It would just be speculating. I know that the district attorney's office has the phone records. I believe that they are, not that they are, I believe that they should look into that to see exactly where he was going, especially a phone call that was made 31 seconds prior to him calling 911. I think that's pretty important. I think you would have to agree with that.
I think whoever he was speaking with, he must have said, "I think I just hit something."
I mean, how are they not a witness? Yeah.
Yeah.
If you look at the phone records, because I've seen them. So the phone rang for 24 seconds and then the line seizure was 5 seconds. So what happened is that he placed this call and my timeline, which I believe is the only plausible timeline, is that as he was placing his call, a second or two before he hit us is when he placed it. The phone rang for 24 seconds. No one picked up. And it went to voicemail for 5. Now, 5 seconds is not enough time to leave a message, even with just a default voicemail. I mean, it's probably 7 seconds or so. But that gave him enough time to place that call for 24 seconds. It went over to voicemail or picked up on an answering machine. And then he looked down and had the phone in his hand, ended that call, 911 call, you know, and it was two seconds later. So don't believe he had any contact with anybody on the other side of that line.
But there's probably a recording on the voicemail on his end, I would imagine.
I believe I don't think that there is. Again, I don't know. I don't know if 5 seconds would be a long enough time.
Oh, right.
Yeah. To go through the prompt, hey, you've missed a call from, you know, sorry, couldn't get to your phone. Please leave a message and I'll get back to you. Thanks. You know, click. Yeah. So I don't believe one was left, but it'd be really good if somebody did some investigating, you know, i.e. the DA or, you know, back then the DPS, and find out if there was a voicemail. And I really hope that the district attorney pays attention to that and, you know, ask questions this time around.
You've done a great job gathering information as much as you seemingly can. And I know Iris has helped you a lot too. What's the story with this anonymous package that you received?
So I received some information from somebody who had been following what had been going on with Katie. This person reached out to me and dropped off some material relating to the last arrest of County Judge Bill Majors. Bill Majors is the acting county judge here in Grayson County, which obviously you guys know the county judge is the de facto mayor of the county. Okay. They said to pay attention to a missed call. I said, all right. So played that footage. From what I read, he was at a bowling alley bar in Sherman, left. There was a DPS officer and a city cop that saw or heard him crash into a light pole. So they went over there and he had pulled into a gas station, and that's when the body camera runs. And it shows, I want to preface this by saying that me releasing that on our social media, I was not going after Bill at all. I was going after the phone call that he made. So I just want to make sure that, you know, that's, I do not want to get political at all. That's not my agenda. You know, with Justice for Katie Palmer, my agenda is exactly what it is, Justice for Katie Palmer. So watching this body camera footage from the trooper, he takes Bill out. He determines that Bill is indeed intoxicated, and Bill had left his phone in his truck, and the DPS officer went back to go get his phone, which would have been great if that happened in our case, and they actually reviewed it, and he saw that there was a missed call from Brett Smith. Brett Smith is our district attorney. So as it appears, the county judge knew that he was intoxicated. He had a DPS unit and a police unit behind him. He placed a call to Brett Smith. And I believe probably it would appear to discuss what was about to happen. I took offense to this when I saw it, for the simple fact that right there, I'm tired of the good old boys club. I believe that's what happened with, Corey and Tarif. And I believe that's what it appeared that our county judge was doing. He was trying to get off, for being intoxicated. I think at that point he was 3 times over the limit. When he hit this pole, and was trying to get off. And you know what happens when you keep on letting guys off. You go walking on your street and you get run over at 7:45 in the morning. That's what happens.
It's unbelievable. Like, it just infuriates me that there's never, like, how is there never accountability? These stories that we hear, and it's over and over and over and over, and then, like, the worst tragedy happens, and then it's like, we're not going to do our job now. But we're going to continue to be repeat offenders, and we're going to continue to contribute to, like you said, the good old boys club. Like, where is the accountability?
There's none. There's none. And that was, and again, I'll say one last thing about Bill, then I want to get off Bill because I don't want to turn it political at all. But, that was his fifth time to be arrested for a DUI, his fifth time. Now this is only his second conviction, but his fifth time.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary in the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune into Hometown History and embark on a journey through time, right from where you are.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hares from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored. Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch unsolved mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the Throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
The grand jury was 2.5, 3 hours, which perplexes me. That perplexes me how you couldn't go in there. It would have been nice if they had that report from the third party to go, That's it. You know, just read the summary of findings, read all 12. And then a grand jury does not convict people. They indict them. They say there's enough evidence to move forward with a criminal trial. Okay. So I don't know if the district attorney's office had a pseudo trial in there and told them only vote for an indictment if you would vote this man guilty. That's not what a grand jury does. The grand jury looks at the evidence and goes, there's enough here for there to be a more thorough investigation and for this to be tried in open court. I don't believe that was the case. I don't know how the DA's office let this drag on for 3 hours. I think there was an hour of 45 minutes of deliberation, then 2 hours and 15 minutes of testifying. I had to testify in there because I obviously was a witness. Tarif Al-Khatib had to testify, and the third party had to testify. And we all know, and this is coming from every lawyer that I've talked to, every lawyer. There's not a single lawyer that will disagree with me when I say, if a district attorney wants somebody indicted, they go to the grand jury and they ask for an indictment. That's what they do. That's what's done. But that's not what happened. And I don't know. I don't understand the dog and pony show that went on August 19th, but it was a miscarriage of justice completely. And it's left our family with this hollow feeling again for the past 17 months.
Jesus Christ, I can't imagine your frustration, and we can only put a call to action out. What is your call to action for the listeners when you go on these platforms?
We need as much support on social media as possible. We had one call to action months ago, and we contacted Brett Smith and asked him to relook at this case, represent it in front of another grand jury. And I think I would ask the same thing now. The DA has the phone records. The DA has had that third party report. Brett Smith needs to bring this back in front of a grand jury. There is no reason why he shouldn't, especially with those phone records, especially since a grand jury didn't see that final report done by that third party. There's no doubt this has to go back in front of another grand jury with all of the evidence, and not just in front of a grand jury, in front of a full 12-person grand jury, not the 10 that we had before. That would be my call to action, is to contact Brett Smith again and let him know that it's unacceptable that this go on any further. So this has to go back in front of another grand jury.
Can you tell us a little bit about Colton's Law?
Colton Carney was going to work one day. His car broke down. He called his dad for help. His dad worked about an hour away. Colton had some difficulties. I believe he was autistic, had a job, very good at his job, loved working. Had an issue with a tire, I believe. And also, I believe he had something wrong with one of his legs. He was either on like a, I don't want to say a scooter, but you know, those pads that you put your knee on and you can kind of scoot on with it. I don't know how to say it. He had some sort of device, and sorry, I'm going off in a rabbit hole here. Colton's car broke down one day. He was traveling. He was walking along the highway up a ramp, and somebody hit him very early in the morning. That person was never asked if they were under the influence of alcohol. When the family asked the police officer why they didn't test the driver for drugs or alcohol, the police officer's response was, it was too early in the morning. No one drinks or does drugs this early. That was the response. Colton's mother, Michelle Carney, who is about as tough as they are, she, as any mother would be, did not like that response, did not like the fact that the man that just killed her son wasn't even arrested, no grand jury, nothing. She didn't like that. She spent time. She contacted every member in the Texas House of Representatives, and only one member got back to her. That was Representative Terry Meza. And Michelle Carney and Terry Meza drafted a law, which is Colton's Law. The spirit of the law, as we intended it to be, was that if any motorist hits a pedestrian and causes either serious bodily injury or death, that motorist will be given a blood test to screen for alcohol or drugs. That was the spirit of the law. And I believe the way that the law is written now, that there has to be an arrest prior to the blood test. We're still working with state senators and representatives. The representatives and the state senators that we've worked with, the representatives are Representative Meza, Representative Smith, and Chairman White. And then there's two senators, Senator Springer and Hall. They have been steadfast in their support for this bill and any amendments that need to be made to this bill, however that process is, to ensure that, again, if a motorist hits a pedestrian and causes either serious injury or death, that it's a mandatory blood test. I don't know why that's not a law already. I know that if I just go up the highway and cross over the Red River into Oklahoma, I've been told that if this were to happen, then it's an immediate blood test, especially if they smell alcohol on you, then that's probable cause there. Texas obviously has different laws. Laws are meant to govern, obviously, but they're also meant to be adapted. And I believe in the situation that we've had with our incident, we can definitely see that the laws that are in place now need to be changed. It doesn't need to be up to the officer on scene to say this guy's okay. I don't believe that he's impaired. I believe a blood test should be drawn. A blood test should be taken. There should not be any doubt. When he performed that PBT 50 minutes after and it came back a 0.06, that should have been probable cause there. I believe that there's probable cause that he could have been drunk. We need to go get a blood test there. Believe the way that he was acting. Tarif Al-Khatib does not hold a certification to do field sobriety tests that test for anything else other than alcohol. So these field sobriety tests don't tell you if the person is impaired on any other illicit substance or a prescription. Nothing. So when the officer, in this case, Tarif Al-Khatib, made the decision not to get a blood test, he destroyed all the evidence that day because all the evidence was being metabolized in Corey Foster's body. And now we'll never know. I know, my family knows, and I think anybody that watches that video knows that Corey was under some other substance, and that is my opinion, and that's the opinion of a lot of other people. But in a criminal court, I'll say, in a criminal court, you cannot prove that because there was no blood test. There's none. We know that there was alcohol in his system, and we know 50 minutes after there was a 0.06 reading, BAC. And that's all that can be proven outside of getting a toxicologist, which I think that would be a very good idea for the DA to do. But Colton's Law, House Bill 558, the spirit of that law would be to collect that evidence at the scene and not let it get destroyed, not let it metabolize. What happened that day has left our family with more questions rather than an answer. A blood test would have really solved that quick. A blood test would have given a baseline, and then they could have gone, okay, 2 hours after the wreck, he had a, you know, 0.045 based on his weight and the way that, you know, his body would metabolize this, existing medical issues and what he ate that morning. This is what he would have been at. Or, hey, he had something else in his system, which could have been a very high possibility that that was the case. But again, we don't know. And it gets me because what I heard a lot of, and we campaigned for this, we lobbied for it. I went down to Austin 2 or 3 times. I've spoke with every single office, all 152 or 3 or 4 offices down there, 2 or 3 times each, whether it be a face-to-face meeting, a phone call, an email, a tweet, anything I could do to get attention to this law. And it always goes back to probable cause, which again, the probable cause in our case would have been the alcohol, the fact that there was reckless driving. And you've got one person going to the ICU, one person it's being care flighted to the trauma center in Plano. But everybody is very quick to say, well, we can't just go take somebody's blood. You know, that driver has rights. What about the rights of the pedestrian that didn't do a damn thing? All I did and all we were guilty of was walking as a couple down the road to go look at some damn birds and come back. That's all we did that day. And we were lawful in how we were walking. We did nothing wrong that day at all. But yet we have to make sure that we don't infringe upon the rights of this person that just ended a life. And I was about a foot away, a foot and a half away. Had I been a foot over to my right, my kids would have been without parents. But it's okay because we didn't infringe upon the rights of this driver that had alcohol in his system already. I don't have a reason at all. Where are the rights of the victims? Where?
Well, yeah, people have this very skewed, warped view of what rights actually are. The scenario is that somebody screwed up, and you need to face consequences of that, so you start to lose certain rights in that scenario, and it only makes sense that someone should be tested to figure out why this happened. There's no rights there anymore. There's no more rights. Like, you have a limited amount of rights now.
And it's not a right to operate a motor vehicle.
It's a privilege.
Privilege, 100%. You have a license. There's not a company around that if you drive a forklift and you damage property or you have an accident, that doesn't require you to go take a drug test. How is that legal for a private company to do that? But then when we're talking about a man driving a 6,000-pound truck that hit somebody 70 feet, again, hit us so hard, knocked us both out of our shoes. I didn't think that was possible. And we can't go get a blood test because that would infringe upon his rights. It would be his Fourth Amendment rights for illegal search and seizure. That's what the argument was. And the way that our law, the spirit of our law was drafted is that, again, the officer would have to get a warrant from a judge. And so once that warrant is received from a judge, then they can go get blood. There hasn't been anybody that I haven't talked to that has either been a prosecutor or law enforcement or a state trooper that has said that a judge would have turned them down in our case. Absolutely not. Again, with reckless driving, with the smell of alcohol, and then the fact that what the PBT score was 50 minutes after, Tarif didn't even ask Corey if he would voluntarily take one. Didn't. That was never discussed with the supervisor. So when Tarif is making these 2 phone calls, never once is a blood test brought up on Tarif's side of the call, which leads me to believe that it was being discussed on the other side of that call. That's the only thing that makes sense. You have somebody that has just killed somebody, again, has seriously injured somebody else, and you, the trooper, aren't asking your supervisor, hey, should I go take this guy in? Like, should I go get him a blood test? Like, this is what he blew. No. Tarif told them what the PBT score was, and that conversation was on the other side. David Taylor, who was one of the other troopers on scene, asked Tarif if he was going to get blood. And Tarif's response to the other trooper was, no. All that was from last night. That was his reasoning, was that the alcohol was consumed last night. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. So he tells the other trooper they're not getting a blood test because all of this was from last night. Now, again, Corey couldn't tell you when he stopped drinking. 7, 8, 9, hell, I don't know. Now, fast forward to the last conversation that Tarif Al-Khatib has with his supervisor after making this statement to David Taylor. He had said to his supervisor, he said he stopped drinking about 8 or 9 o'clock, but I don't believe any of that. It's contradictory and complacency and absolute laziness. I know I support law enforcement 110%. I don't believe that Tarif is an accurate depiction of what law enforcement is in our county. I believe that Tarif Al-Khatib is an outlier and was just lazy and was trying to help a friend out. I believe that's what happened. And I don't believe he should be a trooper, and definitely shouldn't be a trooper here in Grayson County. When you start making decisions like that, you need to be removed and you need to be gone.
Well, John, thank you so much for telling your story and coming on and just being so candid about everything. Again, I know like it's obviously painful and raw, and you're welcome to come back on anytime you want if you have any updates, or seriously, if you just want to talk, like we're open to have you on whenever. Incredible how strong you and your family are.
I could not have gotten through this without their support. My kids and I, that's what we've relied on the past 18 months. You take family for granted a lot just because they're always there. When something like this happens, you don't realize how good you had something until something's gone. And I mean gone, like not coming back, gone. You don't realize how well your life was going until something is taken away, never to return, and not even a possibility. And then you also don't really grasp how much your family means to you until you need them, until you absolutely have to have them. That's what I went through. That's what my kids went through. And I mean, Katie's mom and dad have been with us all the time in their grieving. They just lost their daughter. No parent should ever have to lose their kid. It's not how it works. Same with aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters of Katie. The support that we've had, even when they're going through their own grief, it's been amazing. That's just a debt that I'll never be able to repay. For what we've been through, we can still look back right now and say that we're still very, very fortunate and very lucky to have the family and the friends and the support of the community that we have. Man, I miss her.